This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Coming up, it's as popular in the Pacific as anywhere else, but exactly what is wrong with TikTok? Momentum is growing in Honiara for the removal of colonial street and place names. And a group of Solomon Islands expats are out to set up an elite soccer academy on home soil. Those stories to come, but first, there have been several deaths in Papua New Guinea linked to COVID-19, and the total number of confirmed infections is heading towards 200. Still, the large majority of cases are in the capital, Port Moresby, but seven of the 22 PNG provinces have also been affected, including Western Province. There, seven cases have been recorded at the Ok-Tedi gold mine, as a result of which the mine has been closed down temporarily to allow for further testing and contact tracing. As Bethany Harriman reports, the situation at the mine has heightened concerns in Western Province, particularly among health workers in remote areas who say they're not equipped properly and they've come close to walking off the job.
Rumgene Hospital is a 30-minute, somewhat bumpy drive from the port town of Kyunga in PNG's Far East. It's a rural hospital with 60 beds and serves at least three PNG villages close to the Indonesian border. They're on high alert being so close to the border with Papua Province, which now has more than 3,000 confirmed cases. The border has been closed officially, but there has already been several COVID-19 cases confirmed on the PNG side in Western Province, and it's been seen by the government as a weak spot. Dr. Kevin Pondikau is the only doctor stationed at the Rumgene Hospital. He says they've been relying heavily on help from overseas to prepare.
Coming up to Rumgene, we've been working with Australian Doctors International. So Australian Doctors International, over the past 6 months, they've been mailing masks and hand sanitizers, posters up to us regularly, thermometers, blood pressure machines, some things for malnutrition as well.
But Dr. Pondikau says health workers need more personal protective equipment to carry out their jobs. He says the Kyunga District Hospital has a supply of PPE, but it can't share it. Dr. Pondikau says it would be good to have them just in case, given their proximity to the border.
The testing kits and the Genex machine is in Kyunga, but we haven't seen a spike in respiratory cases.
In the PNG capital, more than a dozen health workers have tested positive for the virus, which isn't uncommon. Global research has found that compared to the general community, frontline health workers are at an increased risk of contracting COVID-19. Despite the possible risks, though, for Dr. Pondikau, there is a bigger problem he's worried about.
The hospital has been on scale down, so we've been scaling down. Because we had some problems with funding.
He claims that hospital staff hadn't been paid for almost 7 weeks until a fortnight ago.
So then we went 6 weeks with no pay, and we just got paid, I think, 2 weeks ago. So the bigger issue for the Christian Health Service, which runs the majority of health facilities around the country in remote Papua New Guinea, is the situation on the pay. But I think the government has released the fund, but I haven't seen the document.
Like many health clinics around PNG, the Rumgene Hospital is a church-run facility, but its costs are meant to be covered by the PNG government. There have been reports in recent weeks that funding had been delayed and even cut to the 500 facilities the Christian Health Services operates. Japilis Kayok heads the Christian Health Services and had earlier threatened the government to pay up, or they'd be forced to stop providing certain services.
It was by July, June the latest, on the end of June, July when we saw that we couldn't go any further. There were about 4 to 5 months of fortnights missed. And so we called upon the government to seriously take considerations of our call to respond to those particular months that our funding did not come. And on the 31st of July, we issued a notice of stop work and demanded the government to respond.
He says the government has now provided the funding to continue, averting a possible bigger health crisis for now.
When we gave the notice of the partial stop work, the government responded positively. And so on the 30th of July, before the 3rd of August, we lifted the partial stop work notice. And as I'm speaking today with you, we gave out the notice to all our agencies within the country to open up for full services. At this juncture, when we are going to other issues of maintaining routine services plus addressing the coronavirus, for personal services, we'd like to maintain that we are the best partner to the government.
Japulis Keok from Christian Health Services in PNG, and the reporter there was Bethany Harriman. Now, the social media app TikTok has come into its own during the coronavirus pandemic, with users all over the world uploading short-form videos. The app is proving to be popular in the Pacific too, but the fact that it's owned by an internet technology company based in Beijing is proving to be controversial. India has banned the app, the United States is threatening to do likewise, and Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison is urging users to be cautious. So what's the problem exactly, and what are the implications for Pacific users and their governments? Priyanka Srinivasan's been investigating.
TikTok is fast becoming a very popular video sharing app. From cooking videos, cat memes, to one-person sketches, the hugely successful platform has been downloaded by more than 500 million people worldwide, most of them teenagers. But its most popular trend? Choreographed dance videos. And these TikTok dances and short videos are taking off in the Pacific too.
The different users that from the Pacific showcase their culture and their tradition through their dances.
Annette Garay is a pediatric doctor from Villa Central Hospital in Vanuatu's capital. She and her partner are both avid TikTok users.
We thought it was pretty cool and it was fun. Most of it was fun. So we're like, okay, let's try out some TikTok videos. So it just started as something new, something different. I found that educational as well, learning stuff on TikTok, like cooking and just learning how to use the camera and, you know, some photography skills, like this, just my hobbies. And plus, I love dancing.
And when Cyclone Harold struck Vanuatu at the beginning of this year, Dr. Garay found another use for TikTok, a stress reliever for many of the health workers out on the field.
The nurses were just flat out after the cyclone and then with COVID as well, preparing the hospital for COVID. And so when we celebrated the Nurses Day, I decided, I'm like, you know what, let's do something different this time. Let's do a TikTok before we started. They're like, what is the nurses? These older nurses were like, what is a TikTok, doc? And I'm like, you know what, it's just a simple dance. Look, we just do this and this. And we gave it a one shot and that was it. And it was fun. Everyone laughed about it and had so much fun.
But as Dr. Garay and countless others in the Pacific perfect their dance moves, in other parts of the world, TikTok has come under fire.
The Republic of India banned it along with 60 other Chinese mobile apps.
The president on Friday announcing that the administration may ban the video sharing app TikTok later, telling reporters on Air Force One that
users are being urged to delete TikTok immediately after accusations of it being a data-gathering arm for the Chinese Communist Party.
The app is owned by Chinese company ByteDance, and analysts say TikTok harvests huge amounts of personal data from a person's phone. And because of Chinese laws, some fear that the company could be forced to share this information with the Chinese government. But TikTok Australia has said it does not and would not share its data with any foreign government.
When we look at the TikTok war, we need to locate it within the global geopolitics, particularly in the big power rivalries between the US and China.
Haiqing Yu is an expert in China's digital media from RMIT University in Australia. And she argues TikTok is being targeted because of its links to China.
Because when it comes to privacy data access harvesting, it doesn't confine to the Chinese platform or Chinese platforms alone. If you look at Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google, etc., they are all collecting user data. However, there is a problem with TikTok when it comes to content. moderation and user data collection. That is, the Chinese government have authority over any Chinese digital platforms. And that's the fact that we cannot deny.
The app has been accused of censoring and shadow banning, a stealthier form of censorship where particular topics are downranked in the app so they don't show up in users' feeds. And while Dr. Yu agrees concerns around TikTok and censorship are valid, she says much of the threat surrounding TikTok has been drummed up.
It's made in China. It has Chinese genes. Doesn't matter what kind of face it takes. So, you know, a lot of people say TikTok is, you know, it's caught in a crossfire, similar to Huawei.
Some say the Pacific has also become a stage for these geopolitical feuds between China and the West. For example, Australia decided to pay for the $137 million Coral Sea cable that is meant to be delivering faster internet to PNG and the Solomon Islands. In doing so, it shut out a competing offer by Chinese company Huawei Technologies. For Michael Keane from Curtin University, parallels can be made with TikTok.
The point is very similar, that the Pacific has become a theatre of war, if you want to put it that way, or a theatre of Cold War. And the idea that when, you know, Huawei itself was a company that was got itself into a little bit of trouble, and it was banned by Australia, it was banned by America. But TikTok is quite a different animal, really. It's an international version of a Chinese-operated company. So, but I think that it's more or less been put in the same tent as Huawei.
He says although it could be a sign of China using its media and technology to promote a new image to the world, he's of the view that it's not something users and governments in the Pacific should be worried about.
Well, I think from a China perspective, they see the global expansion of TikTok as a coup. It's the first real Chinese tech company or Chinese app that's gone global. I don't think there's anything to worry about. They should be as worried about TikTok, I think, as worried about Facebook or any platform at the moment with their data. I don't think that people doing, you know, lip syncing or playful things on TikTok is going to be anything that will be counted as national security issues. And I don't think the governments in the regions have anything to worry about there.
Meanwhile, back in Vanuatu, Dr. Garai says she's surprised to hear TikTok has invited controversy overseas and says users need to take steps to protect their data whenever they're online.
We need to educate them at the same time that the world is changing so fast, especially with technology and especially in a Pacific country where we're vulnerable to a lot of things.
But she says she's not looking to get off TikTok anytime soon.
Everyone's been pretty down about the situation happening throughout the world, this pandemic and all, and just being able to make people laugh, hey, you know, it's important.
Wow. You can really dance.
That's Dr. Anit Garai, pediatrician and TikTok star from Vanuatu, ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Moves are underway in Solomon Islands to remove Colonial Street and place names in the capital Honiara and replace them with the indigenous names of traditional Guadalcanal landowners. The campaign is spearheaded by the Guadalcanal provincial government, and as Evan Wasuka reports from Honiara, it's steadily gaining momentum.
From White River to Point Cruz, Iron Bottom Sound and Bloody Ridge, what's missing from this list of Honiara landmarks are the original names once given to them by the traditional landowners, the people of Guadalcanal. And that, says academic Dr. Tarsisius Kambutaulaka, is creating a problem.
Names are really, really important because names are not just identifiers of places or of people. Names also tell stories. So they're repositories of knowledge, repositories of histories and cultures. And also they give instructions about relationships between people as well as between people and the places that we have names for. And so in the absence of a written text in the case of Solomon Islands and other societies, we tend to keep those things, to keep instructions, to keep cultural stories, to keep histories through the names of places and names of people.
Solomon Islands was named by Alvaro de Mendana when he planted Spain's flag on the shores of Honiara in 1567. He also gave the island of Guadalcanal its name, along with other ones that make up the country.
to name a place or to rename it is to erase other names that existed previously. And so you erase not only names, but you erase the histories that come with those names, the knowledge that comes with it, the culture, and the instructions that come with those names. And so you erase it and replace it with new stories.
Before World War II, there was very little activity here and little reason to be in Honiara. But the construction of a World War II airfield and the presence of U.S. forces changed that. Honiara became the new capital and people migrated here from other islands. Today, the city is home to close to 100,000 people. As it grows, Dr. Kambu Daulaka says it's important for the Guadalcanal names to be recognized. He says the push to return to indigenous names gained traction during a land summit in 2018. And now the provincial premier, Francis Sade, is also pushing the agenda.
We understand that there's a lot of names in Honiara now is from other provinces. It's not bad, but I think the important thing is to rename these streets and places and rivers and streams back to the original name so that we honor the people who actually give this land to the government.
Mr. Sade raised it last week in his speech celebrating the province's 36th anniversary, and he's been in talks with the city administration.
Consultation with the city council will be, that's an ongoing thing. One of the first step I see here is to do a little more research on the name. So we need to do a more consultation with the Tendai Hazard Chiefs, as well as the elders of Tendai.
As for the name of the capital, Honiara, that too isn't the original indigenous name. It was Nahonaara, but changing the city's name isn't a priority for Premier Francis Sade. Instead, he wants to focus on the smaller landmarks.
That would need a lot more consultation with the national government as well. I think for now, we don't want to touch on that yet. We want to start off with the streets and the streams and the seafronts.
Out on the streets of Honiara, there are mixed views about a move towards returning to traditional names.
Good for the people here, doing my idea.
It's a good idea so that we all know what is culture and that we know the real names of places.
What's not culture?
It might be good something, but Latin diplomat, but I'm not sure it work out.
It might be a good idea, but I don't think it will work out the way they want because, you know, we are in a different time. Things are different now. I just don't think it's feasible. This idea.
Impossible.
To me, I'm good for him in naming the place.
To me, it's a good idea, but we should be mindful that if we use custom or sacred names, people might abuse them, and that could create even more problems later on.
At the Solomon Islands bustling city, though, that is no longer home just to the traditional landowners, Dr. Kambu Daulaka suggests any name change needs to reflect other parts of the country, too.
Rather than, you know, having foreign names. And, you know, I know that street naming is not a big thing in the Solomons or in Honiara at the moment. But when they do become important, Solomon Islanders should be able to identify with the place by writing our stories onto it.
That's the director of the Center for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii, Dr. Tarsisius Kambu Daulaka, ending that report from Evan Mwasuka in Honiara. And finally, a successful mission to Australia by two highly promising young Solomon Islands soccer players has inspired a group of expats to start work on setting up an academy. Opportunities for island players outside their home countries are still few and far between, so the aim of the Solomons initiative is to provide high-class coaching and facilities right on the doorstep.
Two against two here. Charles Money running for space. He goes to his left-hand side. To find a goal, he's done it. Rafael Leai.
Rafael Leai was a star of the Solomon Islands team that qualified for the last under-17 World Cup in Brazil. Earlier this year, he and his teammate Leon Cafana spent a month in Australia training at Melbourne Victory's academy, and director Drew Sherman was impressed.
My understanding is they're relocating to Australia, and at such point, we'd have a look at them again. You know, both acquitted themselves very well. They certainly have some of the raw ingredients that we would value, you know, in terms of potential to perform at a good level. And of course, they've got time. They're both young players. So if they were in and around Melbourne and, you know, able to access our program, we wouldn't see any reason why that wouldn't be the case, you know, at some point in the future.
Brisbane-based sports agent Keith Sanger was a mentor for Leai and Cafana during their stay in Australia, and their success set him thinking. How many more young Solomons players could benefit from such high-quality training if it was available on the doorstep?
Doing it one or two athletes at a time or trying to find pathways abroad is really slow. And so we thought, so how do we reimagine some systemic change? We look at a football campus or some sort of academy that provides an opportunity to start that conversation when kids are ready to develop, and then looking at ways to bridge that to overseas opportunities as well.
So now Keith Sanger is gathering a group of fellow expats together with an interest in developing soccer in the Solomons and the desire to put some money into the project.
We shouldn't just leave it to the governing body or the federation. Much like any Melanesian country, there's a lot of bureaucracy to work through and cultural nuances. We've decided to approach local business houses as well as Solomon expats, people who are establishing their careers either in Australia or New Zealand and have the psychological investment to see development back home. So we're just having those conversations with the community in Brisbane. We've had a couple of conversations with some people who are doing well on this side.
And one man who stands ready to help is Felipe Vega Aranjo, the Spaniard who was technical director for Solomon Islands Football Federation until last year and oversaw the historic run to the FIFA Under-17 World Cup finals.
It has a part of my heart. It's a special place and they need help. They need development and also they have a lot of talent. So I wouldn't have any problem to do something like that. But if I am working for a professional club as a coach, I will have to be careful with those steps because some people maybe wouldn't like it. Some people are going to think that the interests are just based in searching for the right players to make some kind of money. But I wouldn't have any problem to do something like this because, like I say, Solomon Islands is a wonderful place. I love that country and it has special talent. There are some really special kids there.
So if the Solomon Soccer Academy becomes a reality, might a leading overseas team be prepared to get involved and maybe put its name on the front door? In Melbourne Victory's case, Drew Sherman says that's unlikely, but that doesn't mean the club wouldn't be interested.
In terms of support mechanisms, talking about it being part of the Club Victory family, part of programs that we work closely with, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, that would be something. But we've got a really extensive support network in metropolitan Melbourne that's expanded into regional areas through the whole of Victoria. That's been expanded actually to Tasmania and Auckland, New Zealand. So our reach is interstate and international. And that sort of program, that sort of affiliation would be something that we would be absolutely keen to reach out into the Oceanian countries. And it's part of our mission to do just that.
But from his base in northern Spain, Felipe Vega Arango goes further.
For example, Sporting de Gijón, the professional team of the city where I am, they have academies in Africa. And there are other teams like Atletico de Madrid that they have academies pretty much all over the world. So usually it's independent clubs that they are looking for something special because everybody wants to find that kind of player.
And presumably if that kind of connection were to be established, then the likelihood is that a club would make some sort of financial investment in the Solomons Academy.
Of course. When you are doing something like that, you have to make some kind of investment, but you have to be really careful with the regulations as well, because FIFA doesn't allow players to go overseas until they are 18 years old. At least they go with academic scholarship. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I think a lot of clubs would like to be able to help with stuff like that. I've been speaking with some of those clubs that I know here in Spain, professional clubs, because I work for Spanish La Liga, so I have good connections, and they all see the possibility, really positive.
For the academy to get off the ground, finding money is clearly important, but Keith Sanger says finance is actually not the main obstacle to success.
The biggest challenge for us is the land. Over 90% of the land is customary, and so there's limited opportunities to get access to that. But if we use that as the deciding factor whether or not to pursue the project, we'd probably not even bother. But it's something that we're willing to discuss with those who have access to that land.
And that land could be on Guadalcanal or in Western Province. There are plans to hold talks with local government and tribal leaders with the aim of selling the academy plan to them.
There's a saying in the Psalms, Mantalim Duim, so roughly translated in English, what your ideas, you know, show us. And so talking to the right leaders is critical. We just know that with some of the support that we've identified already in conversations we've had from a support perspective, not just financially, but technically, there's some really smart people who can really help. We know it's ambitious, but I think, you know, the more we sort of sit around and just talk about things, it does no good for where we're going to head. But that's coupled with realizing that we do need to partner with people who are psychologically invested in the country or friends of the Solomons, for sure.
Player agent Keith Sanger, one of the prime movers behind that plan to establish a soccer academy in Solomon Islands. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thank you for listening.